It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a biologist makes the case that much of our culture, including our politics and our religion, comes from the threat of disease. He's going to join us to explain his theory and what it means for our future.
First, we continue our series of interviews on Act 10, 3 years in. Governor Walker's budget repair bill became law 3 years ago this week, restricting collective bargaining for most public employees in the state.
The passage of the law came after massive protests and after 14 Democratic state senators left the state to prevent a vote.
Yesterday, we talked to Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Today, John Erpenbach is with us. He's a Democratic state senator from Middleton. Senator Erpenbach, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you were one of those Senate 14. You fled the state in an attempt to delay Act 10. It was an act of defiance, and it almost became political performance art. Ultimately, that bill passed anyway. 3 years out, I wonder, how do you feel about that run to Rockford?
Well, if I had to do it over again, I'd probably go to Maui, just simply because it's so much nicer than Rockford was. But in all seriousness, it wasn't so much an act of defiance. It was more a matter of making sure that things were slowed down, simply because this was being rushed through. It was put in a budget repair bill that wasn't necessary to begin with. So in order for people to really understand what was going on and for us to have a debate on it, we actually had to leave the state. Otherwise, it would have passed the state Senate in a day and been on the governor's desk, and everybody would have wondered what happened. So we had to slow things down.
And it certainly upped the ante here in the state capitol, where there was a lot of pressurized climate going on at the state capitol. And I wonder, do you have any regrets about the way things turned out or anything that could have been done differently?
I wish the governor would have introduced it in the regular budget bill. Then we would have had 6 months to debate it. Everybody could have had their say, and we would have voted, and it would have passed anyways. That's the one regret I have, in the fact that the governor sets the tone of the debate in the state. He is the leader of the state, or she is the leader of the state, and they have a responsibility to make sure that all sides are heard on an issue. Especially something like this. This was something that wasn't expected. We expected some changes to collective bargaining, but nothing like this.
Well, yesterday we had Speaker Voss on the show, and he said that a lot of the doom and gloom predictions from critics of Act 10 have not come true. Things like a mass exodus of teachers from the state, things like a decline in educational quality. And he said in general that things are working out well, even for public employees. How do you respond to that?
I disagree with the speaker with all due respect. We lost a lot of teachers. They didn't leave the state. They just retired. And you lost a lot of experience in every single aspect of public service in the state of Wisconsin. People just said, you know, I could stick it out another couple of years and help with new teachers, for example, and show them what works best for me based on my 30-some years of experience teaching or working in any other public sector job. But people just said basically the hell with it and left. So we did lose a lot of experience. It got school districts through a budget cycle or two, but now you see some school districts across the state having to go to referendum for just operating costs just to keep going. So it worked for a year as far as money was concerned, and money in the end wasn't really the issue because public employees agreed to every single penny the governor asked for. So school districts are now in a pinch, state budgets in a pinch, as we all know, and it got them a year and that was it.
We do have a surplus. Do we have Act 10, part of the package deal to thank for that?
We actually have a structural deficit. We have a surplus. We voted to spend money that hasn't technically come through the door yet, and that was through a series of income tax breaks and property tax breaks and so on. But the money isn't here yet. We have a structural deficit. If the governor were serious, I think, about dealing with what was really wrong with Wisconsin, we would take a look at how we're paying for schools, take a look at the funding formula and all of that. But we haven't really touched that yet.
Well, what do you see as some of the biggest problems created since Act 10 was implemented?
Well, let me tell you, let me start with this. If you sit around a dinner table with a big family, some family members still to this day can't talk about it. I can go anywhere in this state and it's either people saying nicely hello or saying something other than hello, somewhat of a crude way. People are still very divided, not only over Act 10, but the way it was brought about in the state and all sorts of other issues that we're dealing with. So, you can just start right there that we are still a deeply divided state. Where changes need to be done in collective bargaining, I don't know. Let's sit down and talk about it. Did public employees need to contribute even more than they already were, which they were, by the way, and a lot of people didn't know that. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. And the real focus should have been, not so much why do public employees have good health care? Why don't you? That's what the focus should have been. So we haven't really talked about issues that really truly affect Wisconsin in a positive way as opposed to a negative way.
What about local governments being able to take charge of some aspects of education that they weren't before, areas like, for instance, merit pay?
Well, basically what that does is it allows a particular superintendent to pick favorites or a particular school board to pick favorites when it comes to teachers. If you're a good teacher, you need to be rewarded in the state of Wisconsin. And for the most part, we have, I think, the best teachers in the country. Despite Act 10, we have very, very dedicated teachers. And test scores still prove that out over and over and over again here in the state of Wisconsin, despite the move to really privatize public education. So, you know, they said they needed to give local units of government tools, if I remember that was the right word that they used. And the local school boards and the local units of government were saying, no, we don't want this. We don't want this. This isn't going to help us. This isn't what we need. But they gave it to them anyways, essentially in the form of a hammer.
Now, in terms of the provisions of Act 10, would you say that they're here to stay, or is there, do you think, a glimmer that they might be reversed down the road? Is that what you're hoping for?
I think a lot of it depends on the outcome of the 2014 elections, and I think Mary Burke's made it clear where she is on it. So is Governor Walker. There's absolutely nothing wrong and everything good with the employer and the employee sitting down and together talking about how the job can be done better. And aspects of Act 10 where that's taken away, whether it's worker safety, whether it's productivity, whether it's all that stuff. There are things that used to be talked about in public sector jobs that, you know, just aren't talked about anymore. And people deserve the best bang for the buck for their tax dollar. And, you know, with the changes in Act 10, I don't think they're getting it.
Well, you brought up the politicized division in the state and that it persists, you're saying, till this day. Sometimes you get a nice hello, sometimes you get something else. And I wonder, do you think, you know, that time seemed historic in Wisconsin history. Mm-hmm. Did the blowout over Act 10 kind of break politics in Wisconsin, or is the state in some sectors, maybe not in your personal life, but is the state in some ways returning to civility?
I think so, but I don't think so. I think so in the fact that we debate issues and we try and debate them nicely in the Senate floor, but the issues we're debating right now are extremely divisive and issues that never in a million years did I think we would talk about limiting voting time in the state of Wisconsin or limiting absentee voting or things like that. So the tenor of the debate has calmed down, but the issues I think are deeply serious. And I at any time, you know, it feels like the state could bust apart at the seams. So, you know, that's the feeling I had walking away from the Senate floor today after debate. I mean, we are close to just busting apart at the seams.
That's the state of Wisconsin, but then you've got Congress as well, one of the most hated Congresses in history. Is it just Wisconsin or is it just politics right now in this country?
It could be politics in this country. I think talk radio, talk TV, and the internet has a lot to do with that. Because of the internet, everybody has an opinion, and everybody's opinion is right, whether it's a lie or not. The tone of the debate, especially at a national level, is much louder and it's more tense. And I think if everybody just stepped back and recognized the fact that we are different, we have different viewpoints, but there are places where we can meet. It's never all or nothing. I think it would do not only Wisconsin good, but certainly would do our country good.
Well, this is, as you know, a big election year in Wisconsin, and Act 10, will it still be a factor going in, or do you think that there will be other more deciding issues on people's minds?
I don't know. I think I'm not certain that Act 10 will be as much of an issue anymore. I do think within political campaigns, whether it be the governor's race or legislative races, I think there are some pressing issues right now that the state needs to deal with. Character being one of them, limiting voting being another one, basically trying to privatize public education and other aspects of public sector service. So there are some really some issues out there that we really as a state need to sit down and talk about. Act 10 is certainly one of those that I think at some point in time, the sooner the better, that we sit down and we revisit and hopefully restore collective bargaining as soon as we can.
You said character. What do you mean by that?
Well, nationally, Wisconsin has taken some hits. You know, not to really get into politics here, but we have a governor with, you know, looking at a couple of John Does right now. We have people looking for jobs right now. We have people working second and even trying to string together three jobs, just trying to make ends meet right now in the state of Wisconsin. And it's basically turning into a state where either you have or you don't have. And Wisconsin has always been a strong middle class state. That's what we've been built on. You know, our families were, our parents were middle class, our grandparents were middle class. And the middle class in the state of Wisconsin seems to be disappearing. And when that disappears, Wisconsin's gone. So that's why I talk about the character of the state of Wisconsin. It's like, who are we? Are we a very conservative state? No. Are we a flaming liberal state? No. You know, we're somewhere in there, in between. Sometimes we move a little right. Sometimes we move a little left. It's never been all left or all right. And so, you know, I think we're struggling basically for the soul of our state to try and find our identity. And in the end, it comes down to character. What do we together as a state stand for?
Senator Urbanbach, thank you so much for coming by and talking.
Thanks. My pleasure.
That was Democratic State Senator John Urbanbach. He joined us as part of our series of interviews on Act 10, 3 years in.
What if everything we think of as human culture is just a side effect of the struggle to avoid disease?
According to a new evolutionary theory, the threat of disease may have a profound effect on our political systems, religions, and even our shared moral views.
Randy Thornhill is an evolutionary biologist at the University of New Mexico. His research on a germ theory of democracy explores the link between culture, politics, and disease. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
When I first heard a bit about this idea, I thought, oh, we're going to be talking about cultural ideas, you know, hand washing or handshaking or, you know, really basic little stuff. That's chicken feed. You're thinking really big here, aren't you?
Yeah, the hand washing and hygiene and all that is just a tip of the iceberg of a much bigger picture about the relationship between infectious disease and many important aspects of culture, including political values.
What started you down this road? What made a biologist start thinking about a biological route to things like politics and religion?
Well, all these topics fundamentally are areas of biology in the sense that biology is the scientific study of all life, including human behavior and psychology. So naturally, biology comes into play if you want to seriously talk about human behavior and psychology. And biology from the standpoint of biology's general theory, evolution, of course, all human behavior and psychology has ultimate causation, that is evolutionary causation. So biology is fundamental in understanding it from the standpoint of evolutionary theory. And so it's kind of an automatic connection.
Well, before we get to the big picture stuff, let's go a little small here. The idea that our everyday lives are full of little reactions, defensive moves against our ingrained fear of contamination. Can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. So our everyday lives are full of the manifestation of our core preferences, and you could also call those core preferences our fundamental values, and aspects of those values are our morals, moral systems. And so we're making these decisions about things that we do, how we think, and how we behave constantly throughout the day, and that's who we interact with socially. Do we accept strangers in our social network or not? Do we stand close to people or distant to people as we move through our days? Who do we talk to? Who do we interact with? All that social life is affected very strongly by our core values, and our core values are coming out of our concern to varying degrees, depending on the individual, about infectious disease. And these concerns about infectious disease are styled in us during our development based on our interactions with cues of infectious disease. And this is these cues we think stem from features such as the frequency and duration of activation of our what we call the classical immune system. So how many times are we sick and how long? That's one aspect. Another feature that styles our attitudes about interaction with others is the contagion that you observe in the environment and how people look. Are they affected? Do they have disease effects in the body and face and so forth? So all this information is processed by psychological adaptations that are for processing specifically disease risk in the environment. And then the degree of disease risk then affects the values we choose as the mix of our, you know, values that comprise our cultural repertoire. And these values, if you're encountered a lot of infectious disease cues, then your values are a collection of collectivist values, what cross-cultural psychologists call collectivist values, and what political scientists call conservative values. If, on the other hand, you have encountered relatively few cues of infectious disease growing up, then you shift toward a different set of values, what cross-cultural psychologists call individualistic values, and what political scientists call liberal values. And those values are styled to be optimal for the social lives of people living in different disease conditions. So under high infectious disease, conservative values protect you from contact with infectious disease. Under low infectious disease, liberal values give you all the advantages of liberalism. You may have some questions at this point, so I'll hesitate and can build on that further as we proceed.
Boy, I have a zillion questions at this point. Let's start. I mean, people used to call this maybe environmental determinism. The type of government you have, the type of religion you have is based on the environment, and in this case, the disease environment you grew up in. Is it that simple? If you're in a disease-rich environment, you're going to be more connected to tradition, maybe more xenophobic?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so conservative values, I am saying, according to our ideas, are arising from a developmental background involving a lot of contact with infectious disease cues. And conservative values are comprised of xenophobia. That's one important component of conservative values. Another is ethnocentrism, so an embeddedness in the local group, ethnic group, so ethnocentrism. A third basic core value of conservatism is what biologists call philopatry, and it is basically an absence of dispersal. So you live and die where you're born. So these three components, xenophobia, ethnocentrism, and philopatry, are conservative values, core conservative values. On the liberal end, you have xenophilia, really an opposite of xenophobia, so a liking of different kinds of people, foreigners and people of different values, colors, religions, all that stuff is just fine for the liberal-minded person, and that promotes high social interaction, building big networks, which is only an adaptive kind of social life under low infectious disease, because as you diversify your social network, of course, you're bringing yourself in contact with more infectious diseases that you're not locally immune to. And so you have the xenophilia aspect of liberalism. You also have the reduction in extended family network, that you have more of a focus on nuclear family in the liberal lifestyle rather than extended family. And finally, liberals move around more. They disperse more. So those are really the big contrast categories of values between conservatives and liberals. And so if you think about these individuals in a region that have these differing values, so in high parasite stress regions, high infectious disease stress regions, you have these conservatives with their core values. In another region, low parasite stress, you have liberals with their core values. Then these collections of individuals, those values manifest at higher levels, and you get then regional patterns in values, and extending all the way to governance of the region and so forth. We find that in regions in which infectious diseases are very prevalent, you get autocratic kinds of governments.
We'll get into some more specific examples with biologist Randy Thornhill. He's talking about the connection between disease and human politics, religion, culture.
And what do you think about the theory linking human culture with disease? What questions do you have? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking with Randy Thornhill, an evolutionary biologist at the University of New Mexico. His latest research explores the link between culture, politics, and disease. He says a lot of human culture, including our political views, are driven by the threat of disease or by the absence of that threat. So, Randy, picking up where we left off, I had brought up the idea of environmental determinism. If you're in a place with lots of disease, you might have a particular kind of government, xenophobic, traditionalist, as you said. That's not entirely fair, though, because our disease risk changes over time. Do we expect to see our politics, our political outlook change after, say, we do public hygiene campaigns that drive off the risk of disease?
Yes, there's quite a bit of evidence in that regard, actually, that you, it's good you brought that up. We've traced the Cultural Revolution, Social Revolution in the 1960s in the West back to health interventions that began in the early 1900s. So you had about 1910, 1920, a lot of legislation with regard to sewage treatment, handling of foods, and so forth. All that legislation really improved health conditions. And in 1920, there was chlorinated water came along, spread widely throughout the West. 1945, fluoridated water came along, and that was a big improvement, reducing mouth diseases significantly throughout the West. 1945, we had antibiotics come along for the first time, really, in any significant way. There were sulfa drugs before that, but they were not widely used because they had such terrible side effects. But with penicillin and derivative kinds of antibiotics coming along in 1945, there was a tremendous increase in health, and as measured by survival of people, how long people live, and so forth. And then child vaccination in the West began in 1945 as well, and vector control and so forth about the same time. Historians of health interventions and medicine have documented all this history quite well. It was specific to the West. And there was, of course, this big increase in liberalism that was the social revolution, cultural revolution in the West that began in the 60s with the sexual revolution. That was part of it, liberalization of sexual values. There was also civil rights, the beginning of the women's movement, a liberalization of sexism that was traditionally the case through the West, and so forth. Many, many cultural changes that came about, we feel, as with a generation or two generations after, depending upon the particular health intervention, you know, cleaning up the parasites, basically. Specific to the West. And outside the West, many areas are still just as traditional and conservative and so forth as they were 100, 200 years ago.
Now, so, listening along, though, I wonder, I mean, in modern United States, we have what we call many conservatives, many liberals living
right
in the same neighborhoods in some cases. Are those conservatives less conservative by the definition you're using than they used to be?
They are, but there's still this intriguing pattern that we've discovered of much variation across the United States in core values. So we use data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention over the last 15 years, number of cases of infectious diseases by state. That's the best we can do, is by state. But there's tremendous variation across states in infectious disease levels. And we find that the more infectious diseases per state, the more conservative the state is, as measured by by values, collectivism or conservatism values, religiosity values. Religiosity is well established as an important component of conservatism. So even though in a country, a Western country like the U.S. that has sewage treatment plants and child vaccination opportunities and antibiotics and so forth, there remains enough disease variation to show that our patterns hold in the United States.
I imagine a lot of people on hearing this might react, well, wait, my political decisions and values aren't determined by disease. There's a history of political philosophy. I've learned things. I've weighed issues. This isn't just my immune system ultimately reacting and forming a political outlook. What would you say to that objection?
Well, I would say that our work suggests that at least we're on the right track with regard to some of the causes of people's political system. The evidence we put together across countries of the world and across states of the United States, and it's not to say there may be some other causes that come into play to shape our whole cultural repertoires as individuals. But we can say that we have some new ways to look at it that are bearing a lot of fruit in terms of explanation and explanations that weren't previously available. And when you just ask people, how did they get their values, they, of course, will all kinds of rationalization and so forth, and they think they own their values and they're precious and so forth, as we all do with our values. But our studies would indicate that there's a lot more to it, and most people don't really know what causes their values.
Well, you've got to be watching current events as kind of a living lab in political biology.
Absolutely, yeah. Believe me, I do.
And, there are efforts, of course, to improve our health. There's a concern of the risk that global warming might bring back some infectious diseases.
Absolutely.
We got rid of. What are you watching for?
Global warming is really potentially a problem with regard to improving the conditions for vectors of disease and so forth. With warming, you'll get these vectors, are cold-blooded. They're insects, ticks, and mosquitoes, and black flies and things like that, that of course will increase their ranges as conditions improve. And infectious diseases in general like it warm. They like it warm and they like it hot. And that's why you get so much more in the way of infectious diseases at low latitudes. And so as those conditions for infectious disease improve as a result of global warming, it's projected, of course, that infectious diseases are going to get worse, and we're going to need to keep up with that. So that's an interesting area to think about, actually.
And on the other hand, if the big national health care plan works and makes us healthier, that might make us more liberal, in effect?
Yes, basically, that's the prediction. So that's an interesting experiment. Especially if it does what some hope, in terms of bringing in so many of the so much of the population and giving better health care, which has been so badly needed in the United States for so long. So one thing I would like to emphasize is that I'm talking entirely from a scientific point of view, and hence we're interested in the causes of values, the evolution of values, as well as the ecological or, immediate causes of values. And as a scientific approach, we can say nothing about, moral correctness or incorrectness. So we're not saying that one pole of values, political values, say, is more moral than the other. That's not part of a scientific study.
And Randy, I got to ask before I let you go, did I just make up the field of political biology, that phrase, or is that something that people are already using?
Political biology, I'm not aware of that as a phrase.
I coined it then. All right.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah.
Randy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, good to talk to you. Yeah.
That was Randy Thornhill, evolutionary biologist at the University of New Mexico. Now a look at the downside of yelling at our kids. Now that spanking is increasingly out of vogue, researchers suspect parents are yelling more than they used to. The research coming back shows that the negative effects of yelling last longer and do more damage, maybe even than spanking. So how can parents dial down the yelling and still discipline their kids?
Sue Schellenberger is with us now. She's a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, where she writes the Work and Family column. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, what do we know about how yelling affects kids?
Well, a study showed that teenagers whose parents have used harsh verbal discipline, such as shouting, tend to have more behavior problems and depression later. And other research, interestingly, says that the consequences may go beyond spanking. 8-year-olds whose parents disciplined them by yelling had less satisfying relationships with their romantic partners in their 20s, for example. And parents who yell just miss a chance to teach their children to regulate their emotions, is what researchers think.
So that's pretty extreme. You would think that actually hitting your child, striking your child, like a typical spanking, would be more damaging to a kid somehow. Why is it that that is not as bad as yelling at your child?
It's a very subtle thing, and the researchers aren't sure of the answer, but it seems as if that the damage done by spanking can be moderated a bit by parental warmth at other times. That is, if a parent is really warm and loving, that the child can still feel okay about himself. But when a child is yelled at a lot, the warmth doesn't make that go away, and researchers believe it's because it kind of establishes a pattern of how people relate to each other. We don't go around spanking each other as adults usually, but we speak to each other all the time and try to resolve anger. And if children see it done by yelling at home, maybe they sort of imbibe that and it becomes a habit. That's researchers' theory at this point.
Is there data to tell us anything about how much parents are yelling at kids? Your piece said, you know, that they suspect that more yelling is happening. What do we know about that?
There aren't longitudinal studies, but there have been some pretty good recent studies on just the incidence of the prevalence of yelling. And some 90% of parents yell at their kids when they're little, ages 2 to 4, according to a study at the University of New Hampshire a few years ago. And it drops to about 86%. Parents yell at least once in the last year at their teenagers, 13 to 17. And the average parent yells about 12 or 13 times a year at their children. This was a Gallup survey of 991 households. So it's a pretty good sample. So those of us who yell, which include me, you don't have to feel alone. It's something that all parents slip and do. And it's also not always bad. You're not always attacking your child. Maybe you're just saying, I just mopped the floor and it's all covered with dirty footprints. It's, you know, you can be angry about that, but you aren't attacking your child. It's not the kind of yelling that does harm.
Okay, so what kind of yelling does do harm?
It's the kind of yelling that becomes a personal attack. When a parent really loses it, loses track of boundaries, and feels just flooded by emotion and begins to take it personally and screams, why can't you ever remember anything I tell you? Or you always get that wrong. Or you're just doing this to frustrate me. Those are the kinds of personal attacks that make a child feel belittled. And ultimately, if it happens too much, amount to abuse. And this happens, of course, when a parent loses control of his or her emotions.
So more yelling may be happening, researchers think, because parents, for instance, can't spank, or it seems that spanking is not a parenting practice that is very much in style for various reasons anymore. So what tools do parents still have left in the toolkit if they want to get their child to behave, they want them to listen, and they want to, you know, make an impact? What do they do?
Right. Very, very good question. And I interviewed a lot of parenting experts on this, and among the best ways is to, let's say you've already lost your temper and you're trying to mop up the damage, you can try to turn it into a solution-finding exercise where children learn to solve problems. One mother I interviewed had really lost it with her child when the kid was really acting badly in a group trip in her minivan. And after she calmed down, she went and sat down with the child and said, that must never happen again. Now tell me, what was going on that made you act that way? And she really actively listened to the child without judgment, and he explained he had been so uncomfortable, wedged between two car seats, and he kept trying to push, and it didn't work. And so he really had his say. And then she said, I understand. Well, what do you think we could do to keep that from happening again? I'm going to give you a choice. Next time you can stay home with the babysitter, or maybe you can think of another solution. And he came up with a bunch of solutions, some of which weren't realistic, but one finally worked. He didn't have to stay home, and instead they took turns sitting in that uncomfortable place. The family, children did, and they also adjusted the car seat so everybody was more comfortable. The kids learn to solve problems. The focus is shifted, and the child feels respected, and that's a really good way to approach it.
So to get to that good place, a parent has to first master their own frustration and anger and make sure it doesn't come out, and then maybe they can have those conversations. So are there tools for parents to keep them from blowing their top?
Well, yes, and some of these will be familiar to folks who've studied anger management or emotional regulation, but certainly learning to notice the signs. If you have a tightness in your throat or chest, you start having negative thoughts about yourself, your breathing accelerates, you clench your jaw, you feel overwhelmed, that is a time to say, whoa, a blow up is coming, and take those calming techniques. They're simple, but they do work. A deep breath, you know, envision a pleasant scene, count to 10, leave the room if you can. Think calming thoughts. You know, I'm having a miserable day, but, you know, it's better than if I lose my temper, it will get worse. And try talking to your child in a different way, too. This can also work. You know, start sentences with I. One mom I interviewed had really gotten angry at her children for repeatedly forgetting to feed the dog, who was always starving by morning. And she started saying, I don't like to see the dog so hungry and uncomfortable. I expect you to keep your chores done and to feed him every night. And then go on to say, you know, how are we going to get this done? And then, you know, impose consequences if it doesn't happen. Turning it into an I want and I expect, what are we going to do to solve this problem, can work very well if you can keep your temper under control.
So let's say you don't and you lose it, because probably most parents will lose it despite their best intentions at some time or another. Are there things that they can say or behaviors that they can do to kind of minimize the damage?
Right. In addition to the, you know, the process I described a moment ago of going to the child and explaining, you know, this happened, I felt really angry, it must never happen again, I expect, and you explain your expectations and then hear the child out, and then engage in problem solving, turn it into a plus, a positive teaching opportunity. Another thing I found some parents did, if it was just really, you know, an emotional moment, they waited till they calmed down, they went back, they apologized. One mother who had really had a problem with yelling did this with one of her kids, and I talked to both the mother and the child said, you know, it wasn't so much that I remembered her getting really angry, but it meant a lot to me that she cared that much about my feelings. And that can really elevate a child's self-respect and empower them to do the same in their own relationships.
So is this going to represent a big sea change in the parenting field? Spanking seems like something that a lot of parents can understand why maybe it wasn't the best thing to do anymore. But yelling, I don't know, in a way, yelling seems sort of more ingrained in the culture. You're just thinking about, you know, the Costanza family on Seinfeld who made a trade of yelling at each other. Is it going to be harder to stop yelling?
I think it is, and that's one reason researchers are turning their attention to it. It's culturally okay to yell, and again, you know, we see these effects popping up in 20-somethings dating and marriage relationships. If they get yelled at home, they yell in their relationships, they are used to being treated badly. It's more insidious. It can become entrenched much more easily, and I think that's why researchers are working so hard to come up with, you know, research showing the damage and also good parenting techniques you know, to avoid the problems. Adele Faber is a parenting expert who's written some excellent books on anger management. There's some other very good ones out there as well. Jill Savage, No More Perfect Moms. These books are really helpful.
Sue, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking to Sue Schellenberger, senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, where she writes the Work and Family column.